Good morning, everyone, and welcome to episode 48 of our live monthly Q&A with Sinton's employment team. I'm Peter Jennings, marketing executive here at Sinton's. For today's questions, I'm joined by Catherine Hope, Samuel Scott, and Edward Patterson. So without any further delay, I'll hand you over to Ed for the first question.
Thanks, Peter. Good morning, everyone, and happy Friday. And it's a Friday leading into a bank holiday as well, so that's all well and good. And it's also great to return for my second Q&A. So I'll get started with our first question today, which is, how can I prevent illegal working within my company, and what are the consequences if I fail to do so? So this is actually a really important question to ask at the moment. We've recently had confirmation from the government that it intends to increase the civil penalties given to employers who fail to prevent legal working. These increases are expected to come into force at the start of 2024, and they're not little increases by any means. So the civil penalties will rise from £15,000 per illegal employee up to £45,000. Repeated breaches will bring a fine of up to £60,000 as well, and that penalty is currently £20,000. So what can you do? Well, the starting point is that employers have a legal duty to prevent illegal working by ensuring that those they employ have the right to work in the UK. So to comply with this duty, you must carry out right to work checks on all prospective employees before the employment starts. You'll need to conduct follow-up checks on any employees who have a time-limited permission to live and work in the UK. You also need to keep records of all the checks carried out, and you must not employ anyone you know or have reasonable cause to believe is an illegal worker. And the consequences being that if you fail to properly carry out these checks before employing someone whose immigration status does not entitle them to undertake the work in question, then you might be liable for a civil penalty. And if you unknowingly employ someone without the correct immigration status, you may be committing criminal offence. So with all that looming over our heads, how can you prevent illegal working and avoid any potential penalties? So first, as I've touched upon just before, you'll need to conduct those right to work checks before you employ someone. And this is just to make sure that the individual is not disqualified from carrying out the work in question because of their immigration status. If you conduct certain checks prescribed by the government, you will have what is called a statutory excuse against liability for a civil penalty. And what this statutory excuse means essentially is that if the Home Office finds out that you've employed someone who does not have the right to work and do the work in question, but you've done your part, you've correctly carried out the right to work checks, then you won't receive a civil penalty for the illegal worker in question. So with that in mind, you'll want to establish a statutory excuse. And there are three ways you can do this. One is carrying out a manual check of right to work. Two is using identity document validation technology. And third is checking an employee's status on the Home Office employer checking service. So we'll run through these, and I'm going to start with the manual right to work check. So with this, there are three basic steps involved. The first is obtaining the employee's right to work documentation. So as you might be able to tell, what this entails is obtaining and reviewing an employee's original documents that prove their right to work in the UK. There's a set list of accepted documents you can look at, but this could be, for example, the employee's passport, or it could be, say, an immigration status document issued by the Home Office with an endorsement saying that your employee is allowed to essentially stay indefinitely in the UK or has no time limit on their stay in the UK. So if an employee's valid document shows they have indefinite leave, then you'll have a statutory excuse which lasts the duration of your employee's employment. So that's all well and good. However, if an employee has a document which shows they have a time-limited right to work in the UK, then what this means is that your statutory excuse is only going to last until the expiry of the visa, and you'll then have to conduct follow-up checks. So the second step of the manual right to work check is checking the documents are genuine. And essentially, this is just checking that the documents are legitimate, have not been tampered with, and belong to your prospective or existing employee. In doing this, you should ensure that the employee is who they say they are And you can do this by checking their ID against other documents, such as a birth certificate or a driving license. Expiry dates are also very important when you're doing your checks, and you must confirm the expiry dates for permission to be in the UK have not passed yet. And then finally, once you've checked the documents, you must make and retain copies of these same documents, and these copies must be clear and stored securely. If you wish to scan and store the documents electronically, this isn't a problem. You can do this as long as you keep them together with the physical records. And in terms of how long you keep these copies, you must keep them for the duration of employment and for 2 years after the employment has come to an end. So don't be in a rush to get rid of them if, say, your employee resigns. Now, making a note of the date you carried out the check is also very important and must be done. You can do this by making a dated declaration on the copies of the documents, or alternatively, you can do it by holding a separate record, which can be shown on request. And then in terms of recording the date, simply writing a date on the copy isn't enough. And this is actually something that we see quite a lot in practice. Instead, when you write the date on the copy, you must also record that it is the date you carried out the check. If you need to do a follow-up check, then you'll need to repeat the dating process for that check as well. So the second way of establishing a statutory excuse is by using the new Identity Document Validation Technology Service, or as it's better known, IDVT. So you can use this service to complete the digital verification element of right to work checks for British and Irish citizens who hold a valid passport, and it's available through an identity service provider. And doing this will provide you with a continuous statutory excuse. So how does this work then? Well, digital identity verification involves obtaining evidence of a prospective employee's identity, checking that it's valid and that it belongs to the person claiming it. And as the name might suggest, there is technology involved. And this technology compares a photo of the individual with the image on their right to work document. This check will then confirm that the document belongs to them and that it's not been tampered with. And then in terms of the results that come from the identity check, you must retain a copy of these for the duration of employment and for 2 years following termination. So again, you've got the same process you have with keeping copies of right to work documents that I mentioned just before. And then finally, we have the Home Office Employer Checking Service. So if you use this service, you can check an employee's right to work in the UK electronically. I'd keep in mind, though, that there are a few types of individuals that you'll need to specifically use this service for. These being holders of either a biometric residence card, biometric residence permit, or a frontier worker permit. These individuals can only evidence their right to work using this service. So if you're dealing with one of these, you can't accept or check physical versions of their documents as proof of right to work. So what the online check will do is that it will confirm whether the employee has the right to work in the UK, and it will give you a reference number. You must record this number along with the date of the check and keep it with the employee's other right to work documents. And then in terms of your statutory excuse, the online right to work check will confirm the period for how long the person is permitted to carry out the work in question, and that's how long your statutory excuse is going to last. So to cap this all off, it's important to note that the government requirements change from time to time, so it's going to be really important that you check what the requirements are each time you recruit a new employee to be on the safe side. And so basically, in the time we've had, I've given you a pretty brief overview, but you can find more information on right to work checks on the gov.uk website. Here you'll find government guidance on right to work checks, and they've also got a current code of practice on preventing illegal working. So those are really useful. So I hope that's all useful for you. I will now hand you to Catherine for the second question.
Thanks, Eddie, and good morning, everyone. The second question we had today is about an employee who has complained about their bonus, and they're saying that they're whistleblowing. They're saying they haven't been paid enough and they're whistleblowing. And the question is this a protected disclosure? In short, we don't have the details of the case, and as you know, in employment law, that is key. It's all about the circumstances of the particular situation and the case, and that would need to be considered. But in short, it's unlikely that this is going to be a protected disclosure, but it's possible, which I'll come on to. When you're looking at whether something is a protected disclosure, you're going to need to look at the legislation in England and Wales, which covers whistleblowing, and that's the Employment Rights Act 1996 and the Public Interest Disclosure Act 1998. And they set out certain requirements, so you'll need to break those down and take yourself through those as to whether something is a protected disclosure. A protected disclosure is a qualifying disclosure under the Employment Rights Act if it's made by a worker and they reasonably believe that that shows a serious wrongdoing within the workplace. So that could be something like regulatory failing, health and safety issues, and that there's fraudulent activity going on, that there's money laundering, tax evasion, other criminal activity. It's going to be something, a concern about something that's dangerous or illegal activity that someone has witnessed at work. And it's really important to know whether something is a protected disclosure or not, because there is statutory protection for workers. So that covers workers and employees. And they are protected from suffering a detriment or being dismissed on the grounds that they have made a protected disclosure. And when it comes to unfair dismissal, if someone's employment or their engagement is terminated because they have, so if someone's employment is terminated because they have made a protected disclosure, so that's the reason or the principal reason for their dismissal will be automatically unfair. And it's important as well to know that the compensation that can be obtained if someone is successful in an unfair dismissal claim, that's uncapped. And there's also not the general requirement to have 2 years service as there is for the normal unfair dismissal rights. In terms of criteria, then you need to look at what is required for protected disclosure. There needs to be a qualifying disclosure. So someone makes a qualifying disclosure if in their reasonable belief they're making a disclosure in the public interest about a certain type of wrongdoing. Now, there's not a definition of disclosure in the legislation, but it has quite a wide application. But the thing to take away from this is to note that it needs to convey facts. It can't just simply voice a concern from an employee or a worker, and it can't just raise an allegation. So there needs to be specific facts that have been raised, which are voicing that particular concern about something that's happened or is happening. That also needs to be about a particular subject matter. There are prescribed subject matters that are set out in the legislation. So there needs to be a reasonable belief by that individual that their concern tends to show that one of those six specified types has been, wrongdoing or failure or malpractice has taken place. And that could be criminal offences, breach of any legal obligation on the employer's part, miscarriages of justice, danger to health and safety of an individual, damage to the environment, or that there's a deliberate attempt to conceal information concerning any of those particular malpractices. So it has to relate to one of those types of relevant failure. So that could be the commission of a crime or concealing evidence about a particular wrongdoing. And the worker has to have a reasonable belief and that information tends to show that one of those failures has happened, is happening, or is going to happen. You'll have seen there has, whistleblowing has cropped up in the news over the past week for really difficult reasons within the NHS in terms of doctors raising serious concerns about alleged wrongdoing, things that are going on within a hospital setting. So it's really important that you're looking at the subject matter and the other requirements of what is required for protected disclosure. It's not the case that the individual has to be necessarily correct about their concern. It just has to be the case that they had reasonable grounds for that belief at that moment in time, that what they've disclosed is substantially true, and that in that moment when they've made that disclosure, that they honestly held that belief in those circumstances. Another really important requirement that has to be satisfied is that the worker making the disclosure has to have a reasonable belief that they're acting in the public interest in reporting that wrongdoing. So essentially, they must have reasonable grounds to show that they believed that the information they were disclosing was going to have an impact on other people. So, for example, the wider general public. And that's really going to be key in this particular question, the public interest element, rather than it being just about the personal interest of the worker or the employee. Finally, it has to be made to an appropriate person. So again, the legislation sets out certain individuals, that organisations that a disclosure can be made to. That could be a worker's employer, the organisation they're engaged by, a person representing, responsible for the relevant failure that they're addressing, legal advisers, a government minister, and the legislation also provides for other individuals to be covered by the legislation if they're not already covered or to be added by the government. So those are the requirements that need to be satisfied. Coming back to this question, it is going to come down to that public interest element. And again, we don't have the detail here, which we really need. But if it's just that this worker or employee feels that they deserve more because I've worked hard, you haven't paid me enough, I don't get paid enough, or I should be getting more from a bonus because so-and-so's getting this and I'm getting this, it's unlikely to be a protected disclosure. It's more about their own personal interest, what they're getting in their pocket at the end of the day. But, and I say, so the caveat here is what's important to note in practice, and if you come across any concerns raised, is that where a disclosure relates to breach of a worker's own contract of employment. So they're saying you haven't paid me what I'm entitled to, or some other matter which refers to their particular personal interest, there may be features of that case that make it reasonable to regard that disclosure as being in the public interest as well as in the personal interest of the worker. Now, ultimately, it's going to be for the employment tribunal to determine, but there was a useful case, really important case to refer to is the Chesterton's case, which was the estate agents. And in that, the Court of Appeal ultimately held that a disclosure made by a senior manager at that estate agent about manipulation of company accounts, and that he believed that that had had an adverse impact on the commission payments due to over 100 senior managers. That was held to be protected disclosure. So factors that you would need to consider and that are relevant in this kind of situation are, what are the number of employees affected? And also, the larger the numbers, the more likely that there is to be an engage that public interest element. What's the nature of their interest that's affected? Is that a really important one as part of their, you know, remuneration package? The more important it is, again, the more likely it is to engage that public interest element. What's the nature of the wrongdoing? For example, is that deliberate wrongdoing? What, you know, is that what is alleged? The concern that has been raised, because again, if it's deliberate, it's more likely to engage the public interest element. And also finally, what's the identity of the wrongdoer? You know, is it the larger the organisation or employer, and the more prominent they are in the public, the more likely again that it's going to engage that public interest element. So the kinds of things that need to be taken into account. So it's just flagging that it's an interesting question to raise, because it could go either way, but it's going to be about the detail. Another situation, for example, where a grievance raised by an employee could amount to a qualifying disclosure is that someone could raise a complaint about a delay in dealing with a dispute about their pay. But if that supports a complaint of discrimination under the Equality Act that they've raised, and it tends to show a failure of complying with a legal obligation, then it could find itself falling under the requirements of the legislation. It's meeting that particular subject matter requirement. It falls within the wider public interest if you're looking then into wider discrimination within the organisation, and it could be a qualifying disclosure. So just to finalise, in this case, the public interest element is the important point, but whilst in nine out of 10 cases, this kind of concern is not going to be protected disclosure, it could well be. And so you need to go carefully through the requirements of the legislation and take advice when it comes to whistleblowing. That's the end of this question. I'd like to pass you on to Samuel Scott. Samuel Scott is a new member of our team, so I would like to introduce Samuel to you and also welcome him to his first Q&A. Thanks.
Hi everyone, I'm Samuel and I'm a solicitor in the employment team at Sentons, and I'm going to be picking up the last question today. So the last question that we've received this month is, can one of my employees bring a claim in the employment tribunal if they have been bullied? So we often get a lot of complaints from either employees or employers that there's been reports that there's been bullying in the workplace. And they'll say, can I bring a claim for bullying? And the straightforward answer, if you take the question very literally, is no. There's no statutory definition for the term bullying. So you wouldn't be able to bring an employment claim and tick the box that says, I want to bring a claim for bullying. However, that's not to say that employers are safe from claims if bullying happens in the workplace. So as bullying, there isn't a standalone claim. There's lots of claims that bullying could fall within if there's circumstances surrounding that bullying that allow it to fall within that category. So one of the main ones that you will have probably all heard of is claims under the Equality Act. So claims under the Equality Act need to relate to a particular protected characteristic. So the protected characteristics are things like age, race, gender, sex, sexual orientation, religious beliefs, and those types of things. What the Equality Act sets out is that people can't be treated differently because they have those certain protected characteristics. So the first type of claim that an employee might have against an employer if they've been bullied in the workplace is a claim for direct discrimination. And this is where someone treats someone else less favourably than they would someone else because of the fact that that person has one of these certain protected characteristics. So say your employee is being bullied in the workplace because of their sexual orientation or because of their race. Whilst it is bullying and there's no bullying claim, that person is being treated less favourably because of the fact that they have that certain protected characteristic. So if there was a protected characteristic involved, an employee would be able to bring a claim for direct discrimination. There's also another claim under the Equality Act, which also an employee may have a route to bring a claim under, and that's a claim for harassment. And this is where someone treats someone differently, and it has the purpose and effect of making that person It's like an intimidating effect, it's a hostile effect, it's a degrading effect, and it affects that person's dignity. And the test for establishing harassment claim isn't the intention of the person doing the actions, it's how it made that person feel that took the harassment. So if a person was bullied, and again, it has to relate to a protected characteristic because it's under the Equality Act, but if they've been treated differently because of their sex, race, or sexual orientation, religious belief, they might also have a claim for harassment if it makes that person feel degraded, humiliated, or creates an offensive environment for that person. And you might have heard harassment has to happen more than one time for them to be a claim, but under harassment, under the Equality Act, it can just be a one instance of unwanted conduct, and that could lead to a harassment claim taking place. And again, like I just said, there is, you might have heard that harassment has to happen on more than one occasion. There is the two different types of harassment. So the third different type of claim a person could make for bullying is a harassment claim under the Protection of Harassment Act. So this is separate from the Equality Act, and you don't need to have a protected characteristic to bring this type of claim. But like I said, it has to be a course of conduct that makes the person feel a certain way. So to be a course of conduct, it has to happen on more than one occasion. And this type of claim isn't brought that often anymore because of the Equality Act coming through. But again, say there wasn't a protected characteristic involved in the bullying, an employee might have a route to bring a claim under the Protection of Harassment Act. The next type of claim that an employee could bring if they're being bullied in the workplace is a constructive unfair dismissal claim. So you've probably all heard of unfair dismissal claims, and you might have heard of constructive unfair dismissal claims as well. So in a normal unfair dismissal claim, the employee's employment is terminated by the employer. However, in a constructive unfair dismissal claim, this is where the employer has breached a term in the contract of the employee, or they've breached the implied duty of trust and confidence that all employers have towards their employees. And the employee basically says, this is enough. I can't work here anymore. I'm resigning. I'm not working my notes. I need to go. In that situation, the employee might have grounds to bring a constructive unfair dismissal claim on the basis that the employer's breached the implied term of trust and confidence. And that could be in relation to bullying conduct that happens towards them. It could also be if they're bullied in the workplace and they submit a grievance and the employer doesn't take that grievance seriously. That might be seen to have broken the trust and confidence that an employer and employee are meant to have together. And again, that could be a route for them to bring a claim. And again, you wouldn't need a protected characteristic in order to bring a constructive unfair dismissal claim. So you don't have to get past the bar that the direct discrimination or harassment claim under the Equality Act would require, which may be a struggle for some employees if they can't identify the reason why they're being bullied and whether it is one of those 8 or 9 protected characteristics that are set out. And then the last claim that an employee might be able to bring for bullying is the one that Catherine just picked up on in her last question. So a whistleblowing claim. So if a employee went to their employer or went to a certain person, like Catherine described, and said, I'm being bullied in the workplace, or bullying is happening in the workplace, and that fell within the definition of whistleblowing that Catherine set out, if that employee is then dismissed or subject to a detriment because of the protected disclosure which they made relating to the bullying, they may also have protection under the whistleblowing legislation. Like you will have guessed, whilst I answered the question in the most straightforward sense, can an employee bring a claim for bullying? Whilst they can't bring a claim for bullying, they can bring a claim for different types of employment issues. And if the bullying fits into those claims, then they might have a claim against you. The other claims that you might have to be aware of are stress-related claims. So normally with bullying, it might lead to mental health issues. It could even lead to physical health issues if that employee is really struggling in the workplace. And as employers, you have a duty to protect the health and safety of your employees in the workplace. And if they did suffer from a stress-related illness in the workplace, it might lead to the health and safety executive taking enforcement action. It doesn't happen very often, but again, it's a route that they could take if there is stuff happening in the workplace that's damaging to their health and safety because of bullying that an employer is allowed to happen. So yeah, those are the main types of claims. So I think what I'm going to address now is just the ways that employers can deal with bullying in the workplace. It's kind of a top tips just so you can prevent an employee maybe having one of these types of claims. So obviously you can speak to us if you've got concerns about bullying, but also ACAS produce quite very useful guidance on their website on handling a bullying complaint. So they say what you should do when you get the bullying complaint, whether you can deal with it informally, whether you need to do it formally, and how you can support that employee through the process. So that's a useful place that you can go if you do have any immediate concerns and you have some quick queries. The ACAS guidance is very good and very detailed at showing how you can deal with a bullying complaint. But again, if you do have any concerns, you can also get in touch with either me, Eddie, or Catherine about that, and we can help with that as well. Other top tips that we'd kind of say is the most important thing is having a policy in place. So lots of employers have a bullying and harassment policy in place, and that's sending out a clear message to all the employees in a company that bullying isn't acceptable and you won't stand for it. What bullying is, so employees understand, because bullying can take lots of different forms. And I think often people react by calling it banter nowadays or jokes, and that those types of things in the workplace can lead to bullying happening, and it might not be immediately obvious to some people. So having a policy that's setting out the different types of conduct that could be bullying is really useful. The other thing is just to make that policy known to your employees, because sometimes a lot of employers, they get the policies in place, but then they're not an immediately accessible place for the employees to access. Having that accessed at all times makes it easier for employees to understand how they need to act. The other main important thing is training your line managers on how to identify bullying and how to deal with complaints. Line managers are going to be the people who are going to receive the complaints first in most of the cases, and for them to be able to react fast and know how to act appropriately is really important. Another main thing is make sure you act quickly. Don't let bullying just go on unchecked. If you have a report, make sure you're looking into it and you take an action promptly. And the final thing which goes alongside that is making sure you keep a paper trail of the instances where you've dealt with bullying in the workplace, showing who you received the complaint from, how you investigated it, and what action you took in response. We say this to all employers in relation to any type of employment claim. If you've got a paper trail of the actions you took and the steps that happened, if an employment tribunal claim is ever brought against you, having a paper trail is really helpful from an evidential point of view if we're working on your behalf. And that's the top tips. One thing which is also good to know is that there is currently a bill going through Parliament called the Bullying and Respect at Work Bill. And this is at a very early stage. If it is to come into force, it might come into force in a different form, or it might not come in at all. But it's something to be aware of, because it's gone through its first reading. So there's a chance it could come into action. And what the purpose of that bill is to create a statutory definition for bullying. So whilst we don't have one at the minute, there's a few MPs who are keen for one to exist. So it is easier if bullying happens in the workplace for them to bring a claim. And the kind of changes that bill wants to make is it wants to set out a statutory definition for bullying. So it wants to say this is bullying and this is what can't happen in the workplace. And if it does happen, it would allow employees to bring a claim in the employment tribunal for bullying. So it would make it easier for them to bring a claim. They wouldn't need to fit it into another employment claim and have to get through some more hurdles. So it would potentially make it easier. They would also try to establish a respect at work code, and this would set out minimum standards of positive and respectful workplace culture. And it would also give increased enforcement powers to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission to allow them to investigate bullying in the workplace and put enforcement action on employers if they don't take the necessary steps to prevent bullying in the workplace. So whilst it is at an early stage now, if the bill does come into force, it'll likely make it easier for employees to bring bullying claims in the employment tribunal. And the employment tribunal is quite an accessible venue for employees to bring claims. So being aware of this change and making sure that you do have policies and procedures in place, that you train line managers, and when bullying does happen, that you take appropriate conduct is even more important if this does come into action. And that's everything. So I'll hand back to Pete. Thanks very much.
So you're aware the firm are working hard to produce relevant and useful content, podcasts, blogs and articles, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk. You can also follow the team on Twitter at SintonsHR. If you've got any questions for the team following today's Q&A, their details are on the screen now. You can also find them on the Sentence website and contact them directly there. Our next session will be on the 29th of September at 10 a.m. So all that's left for me to say is we look forward to seeing you then. Thank you very much for listening.